And let us hope that one day we will be able to look back on this era as a time when we began to reverse the exploitative and patriarchal and homophobic and racist patterns, and that we began to seriously think about reclaiming the future for the peoples of the globe. Thank you very much.
That's Angela Davis, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamian. This edition of AR features Angela Davis on What Will You Say in 2030? Imagine it is 2030. A youngster asks you, what was it like back then at the turn of the century? What will you say about capital punishment, the drug war, guns, or why more money was spent on prisons than education? What will you say about gender and class bias and the huge income and wealth gap between the rich and the poor? What will you say? If you're of a certain age, the name Angela Davis is etched in memory. Close your eyes and you can see her signature afro and clenched fist raised high. But the Angela Davis of yore and the educator, scholar, and activist of today are quite different. Unlike some of our peers from the 60s who traffic in nostalgia, Angela Davis has kept up with the times. Her pathbreaking work on the prison industrial complex has helped push that issue to center stage. She is Professor Emerita at the University of California at Santa Cruz and is the author of many books, including Freedom is a Constant Struggle. This classic from the AR archives is as relevant today as when it was first recorded in the year 2000. And now, Angela Davis.
Many of you know that over the last few years, I have been speaking a great deal and writing about the crisis of imprisonment in this country. I'd really like to thank the Black American Law Student Association and the Black Student Alliance for having once again invited me to participate in this celebration of Black History Month and to talk about some of these issues once again. But I'd like to begin not by talking about U.S. history, but by talking about Australian history. And I want to do this because wherever I go, I try to visit a prison. Those are the places we never enter unless we are compelled to enter them. And, you know, I try to visit prisons, especially women's prisons, since I'm doing research on women's prisons. One of the last trips I took was to Sydney, Australia. And I visited a women's prison right outside of Sydney. And I remember as I went into that institution how I had the sense of entering another dimension, as I always do when I go into a prison. What they call on Star Trek, I don't know if any of you know, watch Star Trek, but a kind of parallel universe, right? And, well, first of all, you know, I imagine the women who were held captive there living not in that confined area, but in our universe, in the free world. As I said, relatively few people travel between these two universes who are not themselves prisoners or who don't work for the prison system. How many of you have been out to Canyon City? Yeah, you see? You should take that drive. I mean, even if you can't get in to see what's on the inside, you should look at that landscape, that prisonized landscape where there are, I don't know, 7 or 8 prisons there. And of course, in visiting prisons here and abroad, it's not only the architecture that strikes me as so similar that these facilities appear to belong to the same dimension, the same universe. It is quite amazing that in this era of a globalized economy and the expansion of prisons worldwide, that you see the same kinds of institutions, the same kinds of regimes, and the same kinds of people in these places wherever you go. In Australia, between 1 and 2% of the population consists of Aboriginal people. You go into the prisons, and what do you find? Who do you find there? Well, I saw a vastly disproportionate number of very young Aboriginal women. And looking at those young women, you would think that you were in a high school. Or that's where you should have been. Now, in general, in Australia, something like 30% of the people in prison are Aboriginal, with the population, general population of 1 to 2%. What would you imagine, what charges would you imagine had brought these young women into that prison? What do you think? Yeah, drugs. Not crack, as is the case here, but heroin. And while I was there, I wondered whether people in Australia had a sense of the racial dimension of the prison crisis there. Now, Australia is a very interesting place because you may know, we're talking about history, black history, you may know that Australia was settled by Europeans, by British, by the British as a penal colony, right? Because after the American Revolution, when it was no longer possible to ship convicts from Britain to the U.S., Georgia was a penal colony, too. You probably know, right? I don't know whether your history books inform you of this. But after the American Revolution, when it was no longer possible to ship convicts to the colonies here, they decided to ship them to Australia. And there's a book called The Oxford History of the Prisons. It's a new book, relatively new, published, I think, in 1994. And there's an article by, I won't mention his, his name is John Hurst, on the history of Australia as a penal colony. And very interesting information about the role that women convicts were expected to play, sexual services for the male convicts. Very interesting information. But I assigned that book to a class I was teaching, and then afterwards I asked the class if they found something strange about that article. And of course, it was a class of 160 students, so quite a number of the students had, interesting ideas about what was, really bizarre about this article. But no one noticed that there was an entire article on Australia and about the use of the punishment of transportation, an entire article that did not even mention the fact that there were people there when the convicts settled in Australia. Not a single reference to Aboriginal people. So you get the impression from reading this article that there was just land there, right? Just empty land. But anyway, that's really not the point that I was going to make. But it is, I guess the lesson in that is that we've really lost our ability to think critically. But what I wanted to share with you is the extent to which now in Australia, people, many of whom are the descendants of those convicts, have developed a sense of pride in their convict history. So there's a great deal of discussion about how important it is to claim their history and claim their past and recognize that they are descended from convicts. And I thought that was very interesting. And so I asked people while I was there whether this burst of convict pride was helping them to understand what was going on in the system of punishment today, whether they connected their effort to claim their history and to claim their sense of pride in being the descendants of convicts, whether they connected that with an attempt to understand the imprisonment of so many Aboriginal people today. And they didn't. There was this total disjuncture. So it was possible for them to, you know, talk about why it was that people ended up being shipped from England then, the nature of their crimes, many of which were petty crimes, petty theft, and so forth. So they're in the process of deconstructing the whole notion of crime and what that means, and basically arguing that their ancestors were criminalized because of the fact that they were poor and working class. You know, doing all of that very important work, that ideological work, but then not relating it at all to the current situation, and basically assuming that there's so many Aboriginal people in prison because Aboriginal people commit more crimes. I mean, you see, this is truly historical amnesia. I mean, we talk about historical amnesia in this country, right? But it seems to me that it makes no sense to remember the past or to try to recover the past if we treat it as a series of events that are dead, that are frozen, that have no relationship to where we are today. And I mention this because this is Black History Month. And we should seize upon this occasion to think deeply about the meaning of history, and not simply to remember and revere and discover the heroes of the past, or to simply focus on individuals so that we look at a Clarence Thomas in the same way we look at a Martin Luther King, you know? So I thought that what I would do as we think about African American history is to ask you to think about, first to think about the present as history, right? And for some, I'm trying to get a sense of who's here and how old you are. I don't know. How many of you are students at the university? Okay, a good number. And others of you are... how many of you are young? Okay. Okay. So we have, I think, a majority. So what does that mean, right? Okay, well, I want to ask you, those of you who are somewhat younger than others of us, to imagine that it is, say, 2030. And you might be about my age now. And imagine your children or younger people asking you to describe what it was like at the turn of the millennium. Because this is going to be an important era, right? Yeah. Although all of the hype around the millennium was really about marketing. I mean, the millennium is already history. But imagine that it's 2030. And there are young people who weren't born until 2010, 2015, who want to know what it was like. You know, just as you ask us, what was it like to live in the 60s? Because you have this, you know, idea about the 60s as being this amazing revolutionary period. Well, we won't talk about that. But think about what you will say if you're asked to describe this era. What will you remember from this era that may or may not be recorded in the history texts? I mean, I don't think anyone will remember Monica Lewinsky, you know, although for a while she managed to occupy so much space in the, you know, public, no pun intended. Really? But let's start with one very significant development. It is said that on February 15th, the 2 millionth prisoner entered the system in this country. So, I mean, I don't know where we'll be in 2030. I'm someone who advocates the abolition of the prison system as a spurious solution to a whole range of other problems that ought to be dealt with in an entirely different way. So suppose, as a matter of fact, we manage to do that. And young people want to know, what was it like to live in a society where so many people were in prison? You know, what was it like to live in a society where half of the 2 million people in prison were African American? Where 17% of them were Latino, where Native Americans had the highest per capita rate of incarceration, although the numbers are relatively small, where women were going to prison at a rate that was twice as high as in previous years. As a matter of fact, I think that there are 10 times as many women in prison as there were in 1970. There are more women in prison in the state of California than there were in the entire country in 1970. So, you know, what will you tell them? Will you be able to tell them how it was possible to persuade so many people in this country that there are people who simply belong there? And once they are shipped into these prisons, should not have the right to education, should not have the right even to lift weights. You remember, when was it, a couple of years ago? When everybody heard about prisons lifting weights? You remember that? And it was used in order to strike fear. You know, these prisoners who are doing strength training, who are getting bigger, and they're going to break out, and they're going to break into your houses, and they're going to... I mean, it's quite amazing the extent to which that whole issue was literally constructed. Will you remember that? Well, if you're asked by these young people, how did it happen? And how did we get to the point where we allowed this totalitarian regime to be an integral part of our society, which was supposed to be democratic? There's no democracy in the prison system. Maybe you'll tell them, well, it got started in the 1980s when Ronald Reagan was president. Or maybe you'll say, you know, there was this guy who was an actor, you know, and he was elected president. And during his administration, this war on drugs was developed. Actually, it wasn't simply happening here. It was happening in Britain. Thatcher was, you remember her? You know, perhaps you'll begin to think very deeply and about the connections. And when they ask you how it happened, maybe you'll say, well, you know, one of the things that began to occur during the 1980s was the lifting of regulations which prohibited corporations from traveling across national borders and from seeking profitable pools of labor all over the world. And maybe you'll say, you know, there was a connection between the fact that so many corporations were, you know, moving to Mexico and Indonesia and Vietnam. And as a matter of fact, in the process, there was occurring something that we call then the deindustrialization of the U.S. economy. And that many people who used to be able to rely for jobs on, in certain kinds of areas could no longer do that. You heard that I grew up in Birmingham, Alabama, right? When I was a child, Birmingham used to be a major steel production city. And as a matter of fact, it was possible to make a good living. At least men, they didn't allow women to work in the steel mills and as miners for the iron ore. And as a matter of fact, the black men who worked in the steel industry had a very interesting history that went back to the convict lease system that was instituted in the aftermath of the Civil War, when convicts were not held in prisons in the South. They weren't held in these huge buildings. They were just leased out to various employers to work not only in the fields, but to work in industry. As a matter of fact, the industrialization of the South depended on the black prisoners, the black convicts, rather, many of whom were arrested for very petty kinds of charges, stealing a pig. I mean, there was a Mississippi pig law that made it a crime punishable by at least 5 years in prison for stealing a pig. So it's interesting that the black men who used to be miners and steel workers in the 50s when I was growing up in Birmingham could trace their history back to the convicts who were leased out to work for nothing in order to build that steel industry. But I don't know, maybe you won't go back that far. You know, maybe you'll just say that, this was a period, the turn of the millennium, the turn of the century was an era in which they talked about how wonderful the economy was, right? But they weren't counting all of the people in prison as unemployed. The unemployment rate would look quite different if you had to add those 2 million people. And then also the people who get out of prison, who, because they're stigmatized, can't find a job and then give up because it's not possible, and they're not counted. And you're right. The sister here says the homeless aren't counted. But at the same time that this is happening, the social services that people need to deal with their lives in a situation where jobs aren't available and where education is deteriorating, sometimes because the corporations that used to provide the tax base are no longer here, because they don't have to pay taxes in a third world country, and they don't have to pay union wages there. So you might also say that as the welfare state was being dismantled in the capitalist countries, Britain, the U.S., and not just welfare, although welfare was the disestablishment of the welfare system was really pivotal because politicians and others could focus on black women, right? And argue that they were the reasons for all of the problems and the crisis, because black women who didn't want to work, who wanted to have babies and get paid by the state for having babies, and who were reproducing poverty, who were reproducing crime, who were creating a culture of poverty. Let's think about how the rate of increase in the number of women who are going to prison bears a relationship to the disestablishment of the welfare system. Because women who are told to go get a job, to get a job that pays minimum wage, are not able to support a family on $5 an hour and no benefits.
You're listening to Angela Davis, What Will You Say in 2030? This is independent alternative radio. You can get CDs of this program and her book, Freedom is a Constant Struggle, by calling us at 1-800-444-1977. Again, that's 1-800-444-1977. Or go online to our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org. Printed transcripts, PDFs, and MP3s of this program are free of charge. Just call us, 1-800-444-1977.
So you see an appreciable increase in the number of women who are resorting to illegal economies and therefore who are going into prison. So maybe you'll talk about all of this. You know, maybe you'll talk about structural adjustment in those countries in the third world where social programs are also being dismantled in order to shift the direction of capital into profitable directions. As a matter of fact, the IMF and the World Bank deny loans to countries that do not develop this structural adjustment. Maybe you'll say, well, you know, there were a lot of people in Seattle at the World Trade Organization, you know, who were protesting the globalization of the economy and who were thinking about the implications, how that has an impact on our ability to envision a better life and build our futures in this country. Maybe you'll say that this was a period in which education deteriorated horrendously in a lot of ways. Funds were shifted from education to prison. In California, California used to have the best public education system in the country. People used to move to California in order to take advantage of this amazing educational system from kindergarten to the postgraduate level. And now, in terms of schools, California is number 41 in terms of the funds that are used on schools. And in terms of prisons, can you imagine? Number one in prisons and number 41 in schools. That's a shame, isn't it? But you might also say that one of the major problems during this era was that private corporations were taking over areas that used to be run by the state. Healthcare? Maybe you'll talk about the privatization of healthcare and the HMOs. And perhaps about the relationship between the privatization of healthcare and the privatization of education. And perhaps also about the relationship with the privatization of prisons, the privatization of punishment. When I was in Australia, I didn't have a chance to visit this prison, but I heard about this prison that is the largest women's prison in the country there. It's located right outside of Melbourne. It's a private prison. And it's run by a company that is headquartered in Nashville, Tennessee, called Corrections Corporation of America. So this privatization is also globalization. And punishment as an industry is extremely profitable. And such corporations as the Corrections Corporation of America and Wackenhut and others are following the routes that have been carved out by other transnational corporations. Now, maybe you will also remember what was happening with the death penalty. Do you think you will? Only if it's abolished. Well, let's hope. I cannot imagine this assembly line of death continuing as it is now. As a matter of fact, if you remember, a number of years ago, the media focused a great deal of attention on virtually every execution. And now it's routine. As a matter of fact, Texas, well, let's not talk about Texas. Because we might not get out of here. What? Well, Florida is number two. Yeah, you're right. You're right. And what's also interesting is that in both Texas and Florida, affirmative action is being dismantled. Well, you know about the recent ruling that abolishes affirmative action in the universities. And it's interesting that these three states are three of the four largest, have three of the four largest prison populations in the country. California is number one, Texas is number two, New York is number three, and Florida is number four. So there's a relationship. Well, what will you say if you ask them, if they ask you, how'd you let this happen? What will you say? Will you say that, well, that was an era during which they told us that racism was basically something of the past. You know, that is why affirmative action began to be abolished, because there was no more need for affirmative action. We were all supposed to be equal. Corporations bought the elections. Well, you know, let me say this. I'm glad you pointed that out, because one of the things I want you to think about is the role we all play in facilitating these horrendous situations, the consent we give, either implicitly or explicitly. And the fact that we allow ourselves to be taken in. We don't question what we see on television. We just absorb it. We read the newspaper and assume that it's all about the facts. You know, we hear numbers, we hear statistics, and we don't think behind those statistics. We assume if they tell us in California, for example, that the population of young people, and they don't say young people, they say juveniles, right? And that's already a charged word, right? That already indicates criminal. And they're already, and they're not just talking about young people in general. They're talking about Latino, African-American young people. That's what they're talking about when they say the population of juveniles is going to increase drastically. And therefore, there will be, and where's the therefore come in, right? You know, therefore, there'll be an enormous number of crimes committed by young people. I mean, this is what they say. As a result, we have to prepare for this. We have to make changes in the criminal justice system. Now, what is the role that racism plays here? Because you see, we don't talk about race in the way we used to. Well, some of us who are older. Now the discussion is all about what? Race relations, right? Diversity and race relations. It's not about structural discrimination. It's not about the way in which the cards are totally stacked against people who are poor and who are people of color. And therefore, since now that all of the laws, this is sponsored by the Black American Law Student Association, so I guess we should talk a little bit about the law. Now that we have supposedly eradicated all of the racially explicit laws from the books. We're all supposed to be equal before the law. Well, it seems that we're only equal before the law in the sense that the Anatole France, the French socialist, spoke about the equality before the law. And of course, he said that we're all equal because no matter who sleeps under the bridge, you're going to go to jail for sleeping under the bridge, right? Everybody who sleeps under the bridge goes to jail. That is equality before the law. But that kind of formal equality never asked the question, well, who will be forced to sleep under the bridge, right? Because of the material circumstances of their lives. Who will never even encounter that? Of course, if you are arrested and convicted of possession of crack cocaine, you will get 5 years or whatever. Everybody, regardless of the race. If you are arrested and convicted of the possession of the same amount of powder cocaine, you'll probably get probation. Now, what we don't think about is the vastly disproportionate number of black people and Latinos who are charged with crack, and the disproportionate numbers of white middle-class people who are charged with powder cocaine. And that's racism. Although we are told we can't call it racism, because there's still equality before the law, anyone, right? So let me think about what that formal equality means and what it conceals, what it does not allow us to understand if we think only about equality at the level of the law. We have a lot of work to do. We have a great deal of work to do in this country if we're going to turn things around. So let's get back to our story, okay? What you're going to tell the young people about this era. I'm really hoping that you'll be able to say that this was the period during which we freed Mumia Abu-Jamal. And I'm hoping you'll be able to say that Leonard Peltier, who was in prison for over half of his life, was also released. But I'm hoping that you'll remember the name of a young black woman by the name of Kimber Smith. Let me see the hands. Okay. I'm kind of amazed that you haven't. I thought that. How many of you ever heard of Emerge magazine? Okay. How many of you read Emerge? Okay. Well, Emerge has actually had a number, about three stories on her, two cover stories. This is a young black woman who's in the federal prison in Danbury, Connecticut. She was a student, like many of you. As a matter of fact, she first went to Hampton University, right? Formerly Hampton Institute. One of the first black colleges in this country, and interestingly enough, the place where also the experiment unfolded that led to the establishment of boarding schools for indigenous people. General Carlisle, in the aftermath of the Civil War, had brought from Florida quite a number of Native American prisoners, and they were released in his custody. He took them to Hampton, where he developed this regime that eventually became the basis for the development of a boarding school system, which was a form of imprisonment. for indigenous people here, particularly considering the fact that many of the native children had, their parents had no say-so over whether they would be placed in these boarding schools. They were literally kidnapped. So there, I'm saying this because there are a lot of historical intersections and conjunctures that we don't necessarily recognize. We tend to think of Black history as Black history, right? We tend to think of Chicano history. We tend to think of Native American history separately. We tend to think of working class history, which embraces people of all races and ethnicities, as separate. And that's not, you know, we have to get away from that. We have to begin to think of in more complex ways, especially before the year 2030, when you're going to be called on to explain what the hell was going on in this country and in the world at the turn of the millennium. Kimber Smith had, I guess, made some wrong choices about who she decided to have an intimate relationship with. She got involved with this man who apparently was a drug dealer. And to make a long and relatively complicated story short, her parents, sort of, you know, upstanding middle class Black folks who convinced her to turn herself into the FBI, which she did. But because she had been hanging out with this man and living with him in part, she was charged with conspiracy to distribute drugs. And ended up on her 24th birthday getting a sentence of 24 years in the federal penitentiary. And I mention her case. She's an individual, but her case represents what is happening to so many young women in this country. Go into any federal prison. Ask to talk to the young women who are in on conspiracy charges as a result of having a boyfriend or a husband who was or is a drug dealer. In many cases, they end up getting longer sentences than their partners. Because if the partners really are involved in drugs, then they have information. They can, you know, they can barter. They can say, I'll give you this name, I'll give you that name, and in exchange for a shorter sentence. Whereas the woman, if she's not involved, doesn't know anything, so she has no information to give the authorities and ends up getting the maximum sentence. I have talked to women in the federal prison in outside of Oakland, in California, FCI Dublin, women who receive 40-year sentences on conspiracy charges. And so, I mean, this is what I mean about a parallel universe, right? See, we don't know what's going on. We don't really know who's there. We don't know the stories. We tend to think about all of those 2 million people who are in prison as being the same. And so you may tell the young people that what happened was that most people in the U.S. at that time assumed that everybody who was in prison was a murderer and a rapist. And therefore, it was okay to pass all of this draconian legislation. And it was okay to pass 3 strikes and send people to prison for life, for sometimes for doing nothing more than hurting themselves or making a wrong decision, getting involved with the wrong people. You have people in prison in Colorado. What, about 15,000? 20,000? And I think the largest proportion of people who are in prison in Colorado are in on drug charges. Well, I went online and went to the web site of the Colorado Department of Corrections and discovered that over 20% of the population of the prison is black. How many black people live in? I never see that many black people in Colorado. Whenever I come, I guess what I have to do is go in the prisons to find the black community here. But anyway, I need to conclude. I'll let you finish the story, okay? But I want you to think about it. I want you to think about the present as history. Because that also will, I think, allow you to think about the past as history in a very different way. It's not only about memorizing dates and names and knowing who did this and who did that, but it's about understanding the events that shape the trajectory that led us to where we are now. And I also want you to think about the future as history. Because what you tell those young people in 2030 is going to be in large part contingent on where we go between the year 2000 and the year 2030. Depending on what we are able to do, you will remember a very different history. So I want you to think about our responsibility, not only to get out there and get involved, and I always encourage everybody to become an activist, and you can become an activist however you want to become an activist. There's no unitary definition of what it means to be an activist. You can be a musician and be an activist. You know, you can get a job in a corporation and still use that your position there as a way to trouble people's ideas about what is going on around them. So you don't have to be in any particular place. You don't have to be the person who's passing out the leaflets on the street. That's how most of you think about activists, isn't it? You know, you've got to go to meetings and pass out leaflets and do all of that. Well, when I say activist, I mean to be active, right? To be active in the process of trying to change this world, and also to be mentally active and to think critically, not to give your consent, whether you do it intentionally or unintentionally. And if you don't do it intentionally and you still do nothing, you're doing it unintentionally. You're still giving your consent. And so let us think about our responsibility to ourselves and to the future. And let us hope that one day we will be able to look back on this era as a time when we began to reverse the exploitative and patriarchal and homophobic and racist patterns, and that we began to seriously think about reclaiming the future for the peoples of the globe. Thank you very much.
You were just listening to Angela Davis, What Will You Say in 2030? This classic from the AR Archives was recorded in Boulder, Colorado in the year 2000. Angela Davis is one of the iconic figures of this era. She's an internationally renowned writer, scholar, and lecturer. And she's been in the forefront of the movement, focusing on the prison industrial complex and its intersection with race, class, and gender. She's Professor Emerita at the University of California at Santa Cruz and the author of many books, including Freedom is a Constant Struggle, a collection of her finest essays. This program is produced by Alternative Radio, based in Boulder, Colorado. We are independent and in our 36th year. We're supported solely by individuals just like you. We feature voices rarely heard in the corporate media, such as Michael Eric Dyson, Ralph Nader, Noam Chomsky, Arundhati Roy, Chris Hedges, Kianga Yamata Taylor, Tariq Ali, and Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz. We also have a series of programs featuring Angela Davis. To access our complete audio and book catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website where we are podcasting, alternativeradio.org. To place a credit card order for CDs of today's program, Angela Davis on What Will You Say in 2030, and for her book, Freedom is a Constant Struggle, just call us at 1-800-444-1977. That's 1-800-444-1977. Or you can order online on our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org. Printed transcripts, PDFs, and MP3s of this program are free of charge. Just call us, 1-800-444-1977. Joe Ritchie is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamian. Thank you for listening. We go out with legendary tenor saxophonist Sonny Rollins playing Olio.